When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, there's some nutrition on board, and then we can start our day. So again, it has to look at that circadian rhythm and those hormone fluxes, which people don't really either understand or talk about, because all of our hormones flux through the day. And so you have to look at, where's the peak of cortisol? How does estrogen?
She's an excellent PhD, and I love the topics that she's bringing up, partly just because they're related to hormones, which is one of our favorite things, if not our favorite thing to talk about. But thinking about their circadian switch of hormones and when to do this and when to do that, and then also the cycle hormones, and you're just an average female and you're trying to keep track of both your diurnal, nocturnal circadian rhythm and your menstrual cycle rhythm, is causing me to be even more sympathetically driven and wired and tired.
Could you elaborate on more oxidative fibers, what that is, and how it relates to metabolic flexibility?
Sure. Yeah. So oxidative fibers are muscle fibers that are more aerobic capacity. So those are the ones that, you know, you can go long and slow for a very long period of time because it uses a lot of free fatty acids. You need a little bit of glucose in order to activate those free fatty acids. So when we look, when a woman starts to exercise, she goes through blood glucose first and then gets into free fatty acid use. She doesn't tap so much into liver muscle glycogen, which is, I think, another misconception that happens. So when we're talking about fasting or fasted workouts, trying to improve that metabolic flexibility, it increases stress on the woman. And so when we're talking about overall stress, we're talking about cortisol increase, and they can't hit intensities high enough with no fuel to be able to invoke the post-exercise responses of growth hormone and testosterone, which then drop cortisol. Mm-hmm. So from an overall stress perspective.
So that's a little bit to unpack there. Let me give people the context. So I just went through the transcript of this podcast because I don't really have the time to sit down and listen to something for 3 hours. And I saw this sort of 5 or 6 minutes stacked together here that had some claims that I thought, well, maybe this will make more sense when we listen to it, and why not react to it at the same time? Mm-hmm. So the claim is that moderate intensity exercise, I guess specifically fasted, mm-hmm. will not invoke testosterone and growth hormone responses, which then drop cortisol.
Correct.
So this implies a couple of things.
One, that the acute spike in testosterone and growth hormone after exercise, which again, you're thinking about area under the curve. And again, this is in, she's talking in the context of females, or perhaps if we give her the benefit of the doubt, talking in the context of individuals who tend to have less glycogen stores in their liver and total body mass because they have less.
Lower lean body mass.
Correct. Yeah. Lower lean body mass. So I suppose you could make that case. That the spike in those does not cause a drop in cortisol. But that we're aware of, no evidence suggests this. And maybe she's making this argument because there just isn't evidence specifically in females, but there is evidence in males.
Yeah, and it sounds like she's stating it as a fact, not an idea to be explored.
Correct.
I think it is an idea to be explored, kind of looking at those and assuming we put some weight to the post-exercise changes, the only one of those that's really shown the most effect size or association is actually cortisol.
Yeah.
The cortisol is what correlates with the cross-sectional area and lean body mass increases after exercise.
I believe an increase in cortisol, correct?
Yeah.
Not a decrease
higher cortisol.
In cortisol.
Exactly.
not reducing the post-exercise. Yeah.
And BioLane has some good content on this. I know he's talked about this study specifically.
Yes.
Unfortunately, for our purposes, you know, this is done in men.
Correct. But, and we'll post all these links below.
Yeah. And women do have the same hormonal flux sort of after exercise. I think it goes back to baseline or even slightly below baseline about 30 minutes later.
Correct.
But here's precisely that running for, I think this was an hour at 70% VO2 max, which is
exactly
not
what,
high intensity.
Exactly what she said, though.
Yeah, moderate intensity. Supposedly not intense enough to evoke this response. You actually had a doubling of testosterone during the luteal phase.
Much higher than in other menstrual phases. Which, so does that mean luteal phase is the optimal phase to exercise in? Is that what she says? I mean,
if I put on my hypothetical hat, and we should get a hat made that says hypothetically, and I'll put it on during the podcast. But hypothetically, if we care about those acute changes, if maybe, let's say, they stack up over a period of 20 years, then it looks like, yeah, making sure that you're training and training hard during the luteal phase would lead to more of that area under the curve exposure to testosterone. We don't really care about those changes, but this is kind of counter to, and this is not necessarily related to this podcast, but she has mentioned that women should train very light in the luteal phase. And maybe that's true if, you know, a woman has PMDD or, you know.
That's a good point.
Yeah, there can be reasons for that.
It depends on the person.
As a blanket recommendation, I have a hard time kind of seeing that, especially because of the meta-analysis by Dr. I believe Stuart Phillips,
yeah.
You know, he's put out that there doesn't seem to be an impact of the time of the menses mm-hmm. or the menstrual cycle and then the training and sort of the outcomes that we care about.
Yeah. And I suppose you could also make an argument that the smaller and also leaner and also just less total body mass and less lean body mass, you might have more difficulty during certain phases, not necessarily phases of the menstrual cycle, but phases of your training cycle. So perhaps you are very likely, especially if you're natural, obviously if you're on hormones, like hormonal contraceptives, this will throw a huge wrench in all these equations too. So you certainly have to account for that as more and more studies do come out on female athletes. So there's a lot that could be said. One other thing I'll mention is if you made me theorize, again, without any good evidence, do these post-exercise spikes in growth hormone and cortisol and testosterone accumulate over a period of 10 to 20 years with consistent training? Locally, extremely likely, yes. So the local benefit in various muscle tissues are likely to benefit you. But from a systemic standpoint, probably not.
Yeah. So are you talking about the specifically like local IGF-1 production?
Correct. For example, does leg day boost growth hormone testosterone that helps you? It does for your legs and for your muscle organ, the largest organ in the body, as Gabrielle Lyon likes to say, but not a benefit for other systems.
Yeah. So we're talking about a local effect and a sort of transient effect. So you wouldn't like say, oh, I want to like boost my growth hormone so I sleep well tonight. So I'm going to go do some heavy squats.
Yeah. That's a ridiculous example, but we can keep going.
I had to use that one. All right.
So from an overall stress perspective, that fasted workout and holding that fast for a long period of time increases cortisol. But then when we look from like a hypothalamic point of view and we're looking at how the brain reads it, so we know that there's one area of kisspeptin neurons in the brain for men, but there are two for women. So the two areas are distinct where one controls appetite and luteinizing hormone, and the other one is looking at estrogen and thyroid. So if you start having an exercise stress or a daily stress of getting up and going on with your day, without fuel, you perturb those kisspeptin neurons and downregulate them. And so when you start downregulating them, we see that after 4 days, you have a dysregulation of thyroid. We have a change in our luteinizing hormone pulse, which is really important to maintain endocrine function. And we'll hear this, oh, I've been fasting.
That's quite a bit to unpack as well. I'm not sure if these statements are strung together as like, if A, then B, therefore B equals C, or if this is all sort of one statement. But the sort of summary is, if you have exercise stress or the stress of getting up without fueling, within 4 days, you have a dysregulation of kisspeptin, luteinizing hormone, and thyroid.
Yeah. And what was not mentioned in here is all of the intermediary steps. So kisspeptin neurons, both in males and females, but to a greater degree in females, come from the limbic system. So that's your amygdala, your hippocampus. And in the hypothalamus, that's actually where kisspeptin neurons, there's also kisspeptin neurons there where it makes this kisspeptin, I believe, but that's where the kisspeptin receptor is. And kisspeptin is a medication that has been studied for hypothalamic amenorrhea. And in general, we do not recommend fasting for people with hypothalamic amenorrhea. We've actually done an entire episode just on hypothalamic amenorrhea and things like kisspeptin, leptin, et cetera, talking about fructose, talking about canola oil. And maybe if you have HA, you shouldn't use canola oil, which we'll link below. So there is certainly scientific backing to this statement, but it all comes from animal data. So we'll link those studies below. And certainly you see hyper extreme changes both for good and for bad when you look at rats and mice and monkeys that are fasting.
Yeah. And there's not really a clear link of where this is coming from. I noticed that theme sort of reading over, it wasn't this author published in this year, this sort of thing where people could play some detective work and then go find the studies.
Yeah.
So what we came across was these were 48 to 72 hours of fasting in mice or, rhesus monkeys. And they were evaluating those effects on the level of kisspeptin signaling, mm-hmm. presumably post-mortem, kind of looking at the mRNA mm-hmm. that's there.
Here's a decent rule of thumb. This is because people are always looking for actionable takeaways. And sometimes it can be difficult. We try to give clinical takeaways because we're clinical doctor and nurse practitioner. We're not PhDs. But if you're hungry when you wake up, then you should eat. So that's my takeaway from the statement. If you're not hungry when you wake up, then you don't need to fast, but it's probably not going to be harmful to fast, even if you are a female.
Yep. I think that's a fair point. Fair points.
And we'll hear this, I've been fasting for so many years and it does great for me. But the other side of the question is, well, how much better would you be if you were to actually pay attention to your circadian rhythm and fuel according to the stress at hand, and knowing that you're going to garner less stress that way? And if we're really tying in nutrition according to that profile instead of following a fast, we see better brain improvements as well. We see more cognitive function. We see less thyroid dysfunction. And overall, a woman does much better when we're not in that fasted state. Then when you look at population research that's coming out now, they're showing in both men and women who hold their fast till noon and then have an eating window from noon to maybe 6 p.m. have more obesogenic outcomes than people who break their fast at 8 and finished their...
So this is population data. So yeah. Presumably she went from some preclinical research to population research.
This is a huge jump.
So an extreme fasting window of noon to 6 p.m. is probably not somebody who's already healthy and doing well on sort of their three square meals and a protein snack, and they're recovering from training and this sort of thing. It's probably someone with an existing health problem that is having trouble controlling satiety of their food environment, and they're restricting themselves to that window. Yeah.
I don't think that this is going to be due to a circadian mismatch. I think because if you fast in that window, then you're extremely likely to binge right before you go to bed.
Yeah, that we see that pattern.
That's
that,
the most common
for a higher protein or a higher calorie breakfast is that, hey, maybe you'll be less hungry mm-hmm. on the back end at the end of your day. It's a strategy to try. Doesn't work for everybody. Yeah. I mean, I've linked to a study here that I like to cite where, if you take a group of people that are habitual breakfast skippers, they're like, I skip breakfast. It works for me. I've got good focus. Mm-hmm. I eat around noon. And you tell them, no, start eating breakfast. They just eat more calories and they gain weight. So it doesn't work for everyone. This is kind of making mountains out of molehills. I don't know that there is this circadian mismatch. And maybe if you look at it, like, yeah, you may have a little bit better insulin sensitivity in the morning than you do at night.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to make it or break it for someone.
Yeah. To give her the benefit of the doubt, I would say a good takeaway from what she's saying could be, do not fast and make yourself hungry between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. just because you're thinking, I need to fast, because you're likely to snack a lot before bed. And just like almost anything, almost any intervention that you do that is going to prevent you from getting diabetes, that is going to be a net positive. Almost any intervention that you do that prevents you from snacking pre-bedtime is going to be positive.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And maybe this is sort of the counterbalance to people that are like, oh, you've got to be fasting 20 hours a day for longevity. You've got to have this 4-hour eating window so you get autophagy and blah, blah, blah. And then people are like, well, now I'm too tired to exercise and I just end up overeating.
Yeah.
So maybe it is the counterpoint to that, but people have the ability and, you know, should experiment and see what sort of timing works well for them.
Yep.
And sort of run your experiment, you know, track in some manner, whether it's waist circumference, weight, DEXA, yep, see what changes and then recalibrate.
Speaking of DEXA, another great takeaway, just follow them today, I guess, is if you're a female and you're over 35% body fat, or a male and over 24% body fat, again, in a DEXA, the bioimpedance ones usually say less, especially for athletes, is you likely don't have to worry about fasting. If you're able to control your hunger, then force feeding yourself in order not to fast is unnecessary, including eating before when you train.
Yeah, there's plenty of people that feel well when they train fasted. Like for myself, I can do cardio pretty easily fasted. I don't think it's necessarily the fasting that I dislike, but resistance training early in the morning.
But how much better could your cardio be if you didn't fast? Maybe your mile time would be as fast as mine.
Maybe that's the mistake that I'm making.
Yeah. And you know, there is, if you're trying to train at a high level and you're an athlete, then yes, pre-workout carbs for anaerobic and aerobic endurance is absolutely performance enhancing. But we're talking in the context of health to most degree here.
Yeah. And I think this is sort of the niche she's focusing on, is sort of maybe these very lean, lower body fat endurance athlete women.
Like herself, probably.
Yeah. But if you're speaking to the audience that listens to the Huberman podcast, it's kind of your general population who has a little bit more of an inclination towards health and fitness.
Mm-hmm.
And we've already sort of gotten questions about this through the portal from patients and people asking, hey, what do you think about this? Do I need to stop doing zone 2 cardio? And I haven't even made it that far into the podcast, but there'll probably be a part 2 to this, if I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But in any case, we'll see what else she has to say.
Ketogenic outcomes, then people who break their fast at 8 and finished their eating window by 4 or 5 p.m. So it's coming back to the chronobiology of, we need to eat when our body is under stress and needs it, unless we have a specific issue like obesity, inactivity, PCOS, or other metabolic conditions, then we can look at using fasting as a strategic intervention to help with those modalities.
Super interesting. Two questions. Is there a protective effect of starting the eating window? And here I'm asking for both men and women, mm-hmm, starting the eating window at, say, 11 a.m. or noon and ending it a little bit later. So not a 6-hour eating window or 7-hour eating window, but extending that to 8 or 9 p.m. Under those conditions, do you still see the obesogenic effect?
Yes, because we're looking at the way cortisol responds. We know cortisol has lots of fluctuations throughout the day, and it peaks about half an hour after you wake up, right? So if you're having that cortisol peak half an hour after you wake up, but you're not eating, then that is that higher baseline sympathetic drive for women. For men, it's not the same. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at that obesogenic outcome, the actual timing hasn't been tested yet to see how can we expand or contract that eating window for men. But for women, because of that cortisol peak that right after waking up, women tend to be already sympathetically driven. So then they walk around more tired but wired and have a really, really difficult time accessing any kind of parasympathetic responses down the way. Where if you have something really small where you're bringing blood sugar up, then it's signaling to the hypothalamus, hey, yeah, there's some.
Yeah, so this wasn't something I actually picked up from the transcript, but isn't your parasympathetic drive its absolute highest first thing in the morning after you've had a night of rest and recovery?
It should be.
So I don't know that I buy into this idea that women wake up tired and wired.
Yeah, the wired and tired phenotype comes from the functional medicine idea that you can have hypercortisolism and then your adrenals get burned out. And then if you look at your urine or salivary cortisol levels, your multi-point, you know, throughout the day cortisol, then eventually they lower even though you're redlined, almost like an engine that's sputtering on only half of its cylinders. So there is some mostly preclinical scientific backing for this. I don't know if she cites a specific source. We'll certainly look into it if she does. But remember, this is a phenotype. And if you study a certain phenotype, for example, people that rate themselves as having high level of anxiousness or stress, then you do treat them different clinically. That's why some people, I mean, you can talk about weight differences with different psychiatric medications in a similar context to this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting. And with looking at the sort of morning cortisol and this idea, and it, I think humans in general are not this fragile, and women are also not this fragile that they have to make sure that they get their, you know, whatever, you know, calories in the morning, or they're going to sort of fall apart and turn into this hypothyroid, devoid of hormone disaster, if that makes sense.
Correct.
I just don't think you need to worry about it that much.
Arguably slightly less fragile than men in a context of aerobic endurance exercise, from a standpoint of how much can you mess up fueling yourself and then still perform well in, say, an ultra marathon.
Yeah, there's some nutrition on board, and then we can start our day. So again, it has to look at that circadian rhythm and those hormone fluxes, which people don't really either understand or talk about, because all of our hormones flux through the day. And so you have to look at, where's the peak of cortisol? How does estrogen?
She's an excellent PhD, and I love the topics that she's bringing up, partly just because they're related to hormones, which is one of our favorite things, if not our favorite thing to talk about. But thinking about their circadian switch of hormones and when to do this and when to do that, and then also the cycle hormones, and you're just an average female and you're trying to keep track of both your diurnal, nocturnal circadian rhythm and your menstrual cycle rhythm, is causing me to be even more sympathetically driven and wired and tired.
So
I just don't want to think about this.
The takeaway,
chill.
People should focus more on their sleep and big picture nutrition, big picture exercise, than the flux of cortisol and estradiol until we get a hormone CGM, right?
Yeah.
And then this would sort of be able, you know, provide her the tool she needs to actually put some data behind these, I guess, ideas that she has.
Yeah. Then you can have a TPN pump, and then whenever your hormones are the right level, then it can pump them in to prevent you from being tired and wired. Yeah. Thank you for calming me down. I feel much better now.
Well, how does estrogen flux, how does luteinizing hormone flux, progesterone, all of these things that have this tight interplay? And the more we're doing the hormone research and the more we're understanding these perturbations and how important it is to fuel for it, to stay out of any kind of low energy availability stance.
And like you mentioned earlier, very few people in the population are in a low energy availability stance. So again, I think this is aimed at that sort of, if you have a pie chart, it's like that 5% of the pie.
Less than 15% body fat females, less than 7% body fat males, perhaps.
Yeah. And then maybe these things do become more relevant and you look at the type of fuel you're putting in so that you keep your endocrine system more or less balanced or online, functioning as optimally as expected at those body fat levels.
Let your trigs run a bit higher, take a little less EPA. Let your glucose run a little bit higher, take a little less berberine. You know, there's a lot of things that you can do other than timing nutrients to keep things topped off. Mike Isratel would say, why don't you just increase the carbs in your diet, build a little lean body mass, not be in such a like a shredded caloric deficit all the time, do an actual bulk phase. Whether you're male or female, you're probably gonna have to buy some new clothes, buy some new pants. Isn't that, I think that's what Dr. Mike says. And then enjoy the excess glycogen overload, and you're less likely to be, you know, this is like the hormonal fluctuations from diurnal, nocturnal, circadian rhythms is a drop in the bucket compared to something like a proper bulk phase like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have a saying here around the office for men, if you haven't hit 15% on a DEXA, then you haven't been bulking hard enough.
Yeah. And we could probably say the same thing about if a female hasn't hit 25% body fat on DEXA, she hasn't been bulking hard enough. Yeah. And health influencers, you don't have to post pictures like fitness influencers, but post your DEXA, your bone density, your body fat percentage, both when you're cutting and bulking. We have, and we will continue to do so.
Yeah.
And a lot of people like Dom D'Agostino, I know he posts his DEXAs. He has some very impressive DEXAs. Mike Israetel, I know he posts his DEXAs. So yeah, post your DEXA and
DEXA or it didn't happen.
Yes.
Regular listeners of this podcast will know this, but just to remind everybody, a sympathetic state has nothing to do with emotional sympathy. It's the sympathetic arm of the autonomic nervous system, which drives more arousal and alertness, and at higher levels, stress, sometimes called the fight or flight response, parasympathetic being the other arm of the autonomic nervous system, sometimes called the rest and digest arm of the autonomic nervous system. They work sort of like a seesaw or a push-pull, pick your analogy. In any case, it sounds like intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding, unless it's very well aligned to the circadian rhythm, is not going to be advantageous for women. That's what I'm hearing. I'm also hearing that if a woman trains while fasted, so in the non-feeding window, so wakes up, maybe has some hydration and trains, that's going to further exacerbate the stress response in a way that's not going to be good.
Exactly.
And I have to imagine that if she also is drinking caffeine in order to do that training, because caffeine is a stimulant of the sympathetic arm of the autonomic nervous system, that it will further exacerbate all these issues. So this is an eye-opener for me because I've had female training partners for years. I don't eat until 11 a.m. I like to hydrate and caffeinate before I train in the morning, and then I like to eat starting around noon. Several of them have hopped on that schedule with me. Some of them eat breakfast first, some of them don't. They do as they choose, of course. But now I'm thinking that's probably the worst way to go.
And it gets worse as you get older. Because if we're seeing, as women are getting into perimenopause, which is in their 40s, and we have more fluctuation of those hormones and an increase in baseline cortisol anyway, then when you look at fasted training, it increases that cortisol drive and that sympathetic drive. And because it's at a point where you really need to polarize your training to get any kind of body composition change, not having any fuel before a high-intensity workout puts them in moderate intensity.
Yeah. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket compared to doing an actual proper bulk. You're talking about body composition change from the standpoint of accruing lean body mass. If you're already lean, which again is the minority of the population. So if you're not lean, then fasting can be a reasonable way to help drop calories, and you shouldn't force feed in the morning. You know, you're like not hungry and you're eating carbs because the science in rats and mice says that you need to according to your circadian rhythm. It's just not a good takeaway.
Yeah. And I mean, this idea that polarized training and getting into some of these advanced things, which is, polarized training sounds complicated, but it's really just 80% low intensity, 20% high intensity training. Mm-hmm. I mean, people can apply that if they want to, but I think the most important thing is people just starting to train. And I hope that's the takeaway from this video. Someone like is watching it and they're not exercising. And because mm-hmm. she's talking about exercise, they're like, well, exercise is pretty relevant to health. I'm mm-hmm. going to start doing that.
If you're a lean female advanced athlete, then pretty much everything she says would be spot on. And perhaps she's just approaching this from the standpoint of her and then other lean rats that run around in their lab rat area all the time, because that's a lot of the studies that she's citing. But yeah, certainly if you're a lean athlete or a super lean male athlete, actually a lot of these same principles should be followed, is you shouldn't be trying to train hardcore and you're like worried about your mesocycle and you're worried about how much zone two versus high intensity training you're doing. And are you doing your strength training before or after? And are you doing your strength training in the morning versus the afternoon? where you can make a pretty good change from just making sure that you're training in a fed state. So there is some good takeaways from here. But again, it is probably 1% or 2% of the population. But it's also probably the percent of the population that's listening to the Huberman podcast.
Yeah, that 1% or 2% is for sure subscribed to the podcast.
Life is, it doesn't work that way. But I'm also one of the people that never really has an appetite till 11 o'clock.
Okay, so right? We're similar in that way.
Yeah.
So how do you square that?
So I make a double espresso at night, and I put some almond milk and a scoop of protein powder in there. So the almond milk is sweetened, and usually it's unsweetened, but sweetened for the carb, and then the protein powder for the protein, because if I'm going to go do an ocean swim, then I need some carbohydrate and protein on board. If I'm going to just go to the gym, then I'll probably just have the protein powder in the coffee. Yes, I'm caffeinating, but I'm also getting the calories for the hypothalamus and getting more circulating amino acids. Abby Smith-Ryan out of UNC did some specific work looking at carbohydrate, protein before, and you know, strength or cardio, and found that if you're going to do a true strength training session, you only need around 15 grams of protein before you go to really help you get into the idea that, yes, you have some fuel on board, and also increases your post-exercise oxygen consumption or your EPOC, so your resting metabolism stays elevated, giving you a better chance for recovery post-exercise as well. If you're going to do...
Wow, that sounds really good. How significant is that effect?
So she didn't give a citation for this. It wasn't in the show notes, but this same individual, Abby something or other, who's a researcher, did publish a study looking at either protein or carbohydrate before different types of exercise. So high intensity resistance training, high intensity interval training, which was running, and then also just, aerobic endurance exercise. And it is true, having a protein serving prior to that exercise instead of carbohydrate. You have to look at this because it's sort of tricky the way they report it. Caused a change equivalent to about 60 calories per day extra you would burn. But they only measured the effect out to 60 minutes.
Yeah. And so, in other studies that look at the same thing, it is usually not more than a couple hours at most.
Even caffeine, I think you get 3 hours of an uptick in your resting energy expenditure.
Yeah.
So assuming it's just 60 minutes, that's 2.5 calories. Assuming you get 4 hours, that's 10 calories. And I don't know that that is substantiated, that a 15 gram of protein, maybe if you're a child, that's an anabolic stimulus. But if you're 50 years old, I don't know that there's evidence that that 15 grams helps you to recover, like she's saying.
The 15 grams of protein.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's saying it from the afterburn effect or the perhaps the thermic effect of food.
But does that enhance exercise recovery?
Is that stacked on top of it? Yeah. It's hard to say if it enhances exercise recovery, but it is very hard to get in protein. It is for females, anecdotally, that is a much more common complaint is I'm trying to get in, 1 gram of protein per pound of lean body mass. I'm trying to get in, 100 grams a day, or in my wife's case, like 165, 170 pounds, however many pounds of lean body mass she has, trying to get in that per day. And supplementing with protein throughout the day is a great way to do it, again, so you're not force feeding. But yeah, the 10 extra calories that it burns, or 5 extra calories, however much it is, it's probably about the same amount as in boogers or semen. So we can
make
those references.
Could undo all that progress.
Yeah. So make sure to blow your nose before you work out.
Yeah. And I think this is fascinating. She's not alone in sort of making these claims. And as a PhD, I assume she would read beyond sort of the headline.
Lane Norton loves claims like this.
But people will be like, oh, you do this and you do this little thing and you take this and then your glucose is lower. And then you go and look at it and it's like, okay, the glucose was 2 points lower. Like you're not solving anyone's diabetes with this sort of little hack or trick.
Yeah. I like to consume things that taste good and that are fun to take. And when I take something, it makes me feel like I'm going to perform better. So I like to take EAAs. I like to take clustered dextrin, like intra-workout carbs. And if I'm doing back-to-back workouts, I like to, if I'm doing a CrossFit comp, then yeah, I'll absolutely take something like that in between workouts. I'll take some protein shake before too, with whatever other things, creatine, taurine, et cetera. So I'm on board for having this as a recommendation in general, but the calorie effect is negligible.
Yeah, and I pulled some interesting data from this. They actually didn't look at protein in the context of cortisol, whether it offset that. That sounds to me like a claim she was making, quote, helps you get the idea that, yes, you have some fuel on board. Not super technical, so it's kind of hard to make anything of that statement and what the specific claim is. But this was true high-intensity running heart rate was, you know, averaging 184 during this.
Wow.
You know, pretty intense training, whereas the others were down in the 120s. And then if you go look at the chart of the cortisol pre and post, it's very similar to a certain study on Tongkat Ali. Also, this was no statistically significant effect of any exercise modality on cortisol.
Yeah.
To me, that is kind of bizarre because you can see, like, I think a doubling or even tripling of serum cortisol from that sort of intensity of the exercise. Mm-hmm. Seems to be tied more to the intensity than the duration of exercise. And perhaps those changes just don't happen as quickly in the saliva, but it looks like they are happening to some degree.
Yeah, it just was a small sample size.
Yeah, so you had a 33% increase in the salivary cortisol after the high-intensity interval training, reported as not statistically significant.
Mm-hmm. Did they account for the confounder of if they used CrossFit as HIIT training, all of the jams that they play during the workout, Zombie Nation pumping in the background?
Yeah, all of the ergogenic effect of music. I think that's a paper I posted on Instagram at some point.
Yeah.
If you have to listen to music you don't like, it harms your performance. Music you do like helps your performance and delays fatigue.
Yeah. That sounds like a great hack and takeaway, perhaps even more so than my mostly placebo EAAs.
To be fair, I posted that one without reading into it because I like the study. It may be something like, oh, yeah, they got one more rep, or they got, I love the ones that are like an extra 2 meters in the 6 minute walk test. Mm-hmm.
I like the hack of trying to smile when you run or do HIIT, even though it's exceedingly painful. Yeah, I don't know if it helps, and I also kind of don't want to know. Because then if I read that it doesn't help, then I'll stop doing it and I won't get that little boost.
You won't be as photogenic.
I guess so. Anyway, I think that summarizes most of our takeaways.
Yeah, those are some of the things we went through. There's more to be unpacked here. You know, there's claims about the menstrual cycle, zone 2 cardio, and so forth that are sort of, I guess, counter to the current exercise recommendations. So if there's certain things that were said on the podcast you want us to take a look at and see what the evidence says and see why theoretically maybe this does make sense or maybe it doesn't for certain populations, please do let us know in the comments. We love to dive into those sorts of things. And this is another one of our sort of, I guess, reacting to or correcting series in the podcast. So if you like this, let us know. If you don't like it, let us know. This format's a little bit different. We did pull some citations, look at the transcript ahead of time. But our reaction to the video is the initial reaction, which I think is nice. I did pick up on some things that I didn't get from just reading the text. Please don't read the transcript of our podcast because we're very sarcastic and you will come away with a very confused take on that.
Yeah, or do and leave both nice and mean comments. Like we like to say, we love the nice comments. The mean comments help the algorithm arguably even more because they tend to get some responses. So as always, we hope that you got a lot of takeaways. Feel free to let us know your thoughts. And as usual, thank you for listening. May God bless you with health and happiness.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.